threatens.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
There's a curious incident recorded in the first four verses of chapter 6 of the book of Genesis that has a lot more influence over the rest of the Bible than any of us thought. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest, the scholar-in-residence at Logos Bible Software, the author of a number of books, including I Dare You Not to Bore Me with the Bible, The Unseen Realm, Recovering the Supernatural Worldview of the Bible, and a forthcoming book with the working title, Reversing Hermann, The Importance of the Sin of the Watchers in the Book of Enoch for New Testament Theology. He's a little bleary-eyed, as am I, because we've just finished up about, 9 hours of content for Skywatch TV over the last 2 days. But in studio with us, Dr. Michael Heiser. Mike, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This has been a kind of a marathon session, but it's been good stuff. We focused on in the Skywatch interviews on the Unseen Realm, and then also today for programs on Reversing Hermann, the book that you're working on. So I guess in general, over the next 45 minutes to an hour or so, just maybe revisit some of the things we've been talking about. It'll be hard to remember. Did we discuss that or not?
Because if you forget, you know, we can talk about the Naked Bible Fantasy Baseball League.
Yeah, there's that too, because that I'm sure listeners are always intrigued by that.
They're waving the family members to the radio right now.
Because we got some other folks in that league that listeners would be familiar with, like David W. Lowe for one, Mark Combs for another. The influence, and I've been listening to your Naked Bible podcast, by the way, and recent programs that you've done, especially the one with David Burnett, was really fascinating, because it's become clear that even though I think those of us who are now familiar with the Genesis 6 paradigm, and the Nephilim, which has become kind of I didn't even realize this. One of those days where I had a wild hair. Okay, I just have to Google myself just to find out what's going on out there. Who's saying what about me?
I've never had the courage to do that.
Yeah, and I probably never should because it's kind of silly. But I found that there are some places on the internet as of a few years ago that I was being referred to as the Nephilim guy, which I thought, well, that's odd because I don't think I've ever done that much on this particular topic. But anyway, we're familiar with the Nephilim and the problems that they caused and how that may in all likelihood, been responsible for the flood, or at least in part responsible for Yahweh's decision to just, okay, let's wipe the slate clean, except for Noah and his family. But there's more to the influence that of the sin of the Watchers on the New Testament than I ever suspected. And this is really exciting stuff. In a nutshell, what was the sin of the Watchers, for those who are new to the concept? And then secondly, how did the New Testament writers process that and address it in their writings?
Well, the sin of the Watchers, again, the most familiar component to it, for those who have even heard the term and, you know, take Genesis 6 sort of at face value and, you know, familiar with things like the Nephilim, the most, you know, transparent answer to it is this transgression. Because in Genesis 6, 1 through 4, you get the sons of God, you know, married or taken marriage, the human women, they produce the Nephilim and so on and so forth. The Enoch version, again, First Enoch, a book written between the Testaments about this incident, refers to the sons of God as watchers. And so there you get the sin of the Watchers being this transgression that we read about in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. But there's a second component to it, a second element, and that is in Enoch, the Watchers are, you know, credited is the wrong word, blamed is probably a better word, with teaching humanity certain things that wind up corrupting humanity. We get a reference to the corruption in Genesis 6. The very next verse, Genesis 6:5, talks about the wickedness of humans was great, and that every thought of the imagination of their hearts was only evil continually. And you go, well, how in the world do you go to that? How do you get to this statement about human depravity from the first four verses? You know, it's just so strange. Well, the answer is, again, if you're reading Enoch, he tells you why this assessment of humanity is what it is. And that is because humankind is corrupted thoroughly by what the Watchers teach them. You know, arts of warfare, astrology, seduction, you know, illicit sexual behavior.
Potions, magic. Right, yeah.
Magic, you know, all that kind of stuff. So for a Jew, again, thinking about this issue or hearing even your question, they would blame depravity not on Genesis 3, even though they would say, well, yeah, that's where sin entered the world and, you know, God's good world is corrupted and so on and so forth. We have human rebellion and divine rebellion with the serpent. But they would say that the real problem here, the root of the proliferation of wickedness, is laid at the feet of the Watchers. And that isn't a contrived view. That actually reflects, as I'm going to deal with in this book, and I do deal with it in a couple chapters early on in the book, that the original Mesopotamian story that Genesis 6:1 through 4 is written to target, again, some specific points of Babylonian mythology, Babylonian religion, that story does also include this idea of the transmission of divine knowledge. You know, the villains there are the Apkallu. They're divine before the flood. After the flood, they are semi-divine. They are, quote, of human descent. And they're off, you know, they are the offspring of the original, you know, lair, the original divine beings, and they're also giants. So you get all the elements there in the Mesopotamian story, and the Enoch material preserves that. The Enoch material, again, is aware, the writer was aware of the original context of Genesis 6:1 through 4. But all we get in Genesis is, well, we got this episode, this transgression, and then humans are just awful. So there's this missing element that Enoch, you know, helps preserve for us.
The Apkallu, an interesting, actually fascinating group, and you've talked about this before in a previous interview, where a paper written in 2010 by scholar Amar Anus, who's a university in Estonia.
Of all places.
came out with this paper where he actually went back into the Mesopotamian literature and found references to these Apkallu and then tied that... I think the title of the paper is On the Origin of the Watchers. It's a fascinating read. But prior to that, what was the scholarly consensus on the Watchers in Jewish literature?
Yeah, Anus's work in 2010 was the first systematic redoing, you know, the systematic revisitation of Mesopotamian flood stories, which, you know, is sort of part of the broad knowledge of in Western culture about the Bible, that, hey, there are flood stories over in Mesopotamia too. Everybody sort of knows this. But Anus was the first one to go back into that material with a specific eye toward, hey, is there stuff there that resembles the first four verses of Genesis? You know, these divine guys, and then the flood, and after the flood, and the Nephilim, and he's weird, again, mixed offspring, that sort of thing. And so that's why his work is really valuable. Up until that time, there are a few journal articles, maybe a commentary or two that mention the Apkallu, but no one ties them into the story, again, the specific rationale for Genesis 6:1 through 4, like Anus's work does. And also, again, this was before 2010, but part of this sort of getting up to speed with primary sources, again, to help us look at the Bible and read it more intelligently, again, like an Israelite would have, or like a first century Jew would have, is also very recently a critical edition of the Book of the Giants. Okay, the Book of the Giants is a book found in fragmentary form among the Dead Sea Scrolls. And again, amazingly, Gilgamesh, you know, who's a central figure in the Apkallu story. Gilgamesh is called Lord of the Apkallu. He is one of the post-flood Apkallu that is two-thirds divine and a giant, okay? Well, Gilgamesh is named as one of the giants, the surviving the flood, in the Book of the Giants found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. So again, here you have another indication besides the Book of First Enoch, and what we popularly refer to as the Book of Enoch. But here you have another book that, again, preserves and taps into this original context about the Apkallu and the giants, you know, by virtue of Gilgamesh.
And you mentioned in the Book of the Giants, and this was in one of the discussions we had for Skywatch TV, that another figure from the Gilgamesh epic is referenced in the Book of the Giants, very possibly anyway, the monster that he goes to slay, or Humbawa.
Humbawa,
what I think was as fascinating is I've been doing some reading on scholarly papers of Canaanite, Mesopotamian, Babylonian cosmology for a project I'm working on. Mm-hmm. I hesitate to say a book, but I guess if I say it often enough, I'll shame myself into actually finishing it because I've gone public.
It'll turn out to be a book.
There was a paper written, a paper published about 40 years ago by a scholar named Edward Lipinski on the abode of El. The chief god of the Canaanite pantheon. And he points out that in that paper that Gilgamesh was known in the Gilgamesh epic as, or rather Humbawa, that was known as the guardian of the abode of the gods. Mm-hmm. And he makes a pretty strong case that where Gilgamesh and his friend Enkidu traveled to defeat Humbawa was Mount Hermon, which again ties them back to the Watchers.
It's another connection. That wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, it's been a while since I looked at Lipinski's art. I read that because for my dissertation, really about the council language. But now that you mention it, I want to go back and see specifically what he says in that regard. But it wouldn't surprise me at all. There are some book-length manuscripts. There's a scholar, Helge, it's H-E-L-G-E, and it's actually a man. It's a man's name, Kvanvig, K-V-A-N-V-I-G, who wrote a whole book on the Mesopotamian roots of apocalyptic literature and specifically the Enoch traditions.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of material, found in and that you can tap into in terms of Mesopotamian stuff that relates to Enochian stuff in the later period that we call the Second Temple period within Judaism. So that wouldn't surprise me at all. There are a lot of connections there.
Hmm. So let's come back again to the sin of the Watchers and the knowledge that they transmitted to humanity that we weren't supposed to know, and how then the disciples, the apostles, the writers of the New Testament filtered that into the books that we've come to know as the New Testament. Mm-hmm. How does that show up in Christian theology?
Yeah, it actually becomes an important touch point for theological messaging about the appearance of the Messiah and also what the Messiah was here to do. It factors into how we would read Revelation 12, the whole birth of the Messiah. Again, if we take Revelation 12 seriously as astral prophecy as a specific example of that genre. And I've talked on my podcast before and, other contexts about the work of Bruce Malina, M-A-L-I-N-A, who wrote a book called The Genre and Meaning of the Book of Revelation. And it's the first systematic treatment of, Revelation as astral prophecy, which again is a known genre in the Second Temple period associated with apocalyptic stuff, like Revelation obviously is. But if we take that seriously, Revelation 12, the astral signs there, that sort of gives us a hint at what the Magi were looking at and what they were thinking, this whole concatenation of signs. And if you plot that out in an astronomy program, you essentially follow their directions. You come out with a date for the birth of the Messiah that coincides with Tishri 1 on the Jewish calendar, which in Jewish tradition was thought to be the birth of Noah. So Noah becomes, again, this type of Jesus, of the Messiah. And how, Mike? Well, think about who Noah was. Again, Noah is viewed as righteous. He survives the flood. His survival of the flood, is essentially the symbolic reference point for what? Well, for the judgment of the Watchers, because they are sent to the abyss, after the events of Genesis 6, 1 through 4. And also, again, the whole judgment of the flood in terms of wiping out the Nephilim. So when you thought of Noah as a Jew, you thought of those things. Well, if Noah's birthday happens to be the same birthday as the Messiah, the theological messaging is pretty transparent. Well, the Messiah is here, again, to judge evil. He is the one that's going to produce the final death of the gods, the final judgment on those divine beings who are imprisoned. The whole lake of fire thing, the devil and his angels cast in the lake of fire. He's the one who's going to reverse the effects of human depravity that was brought to humanity by the Watchers. He becomes the great roller back, of evil, that to a Jew wasn't just about Genesis 3. it was also about Genesis 6. There are things in Jesus' genealogy, the women present in the genealogy. And again, I realize a lot of this stuff sounds really, you know, kind of crazy and weird, but this is everything in the book, again, comes from scholarly peer-reviewed journal articles or dissertations. Academics talk about this stuff all the time. It just never filters down into the church, and no one's taken it all and put it into a book form and said, hey, the Book of Enoch, you know, was really important to the New Testament, specifically the Sin of the Watchers, and here you go. I mean, that's the purpose of the book. But the four women in the genealogies, the circumstances of their life, the words and phrases, again, the imagery that's used in the description of the lives of those four women in both the Hebrew Bible and the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, and in Aramaic targums, lo and behold, those terms show up in the episode of the Sin of the Watchers, you know, in the Book of Enoch or in the Septuagint, you know, when it comes to the Genesis 6, 1 through 4. Is that a coincidence? Well, the Jews didn't think so. And so the messaging is that these four women, the genealogies are there not to tell us something that we already knew, like, hey, God likes Gentiles too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
No, they're actually there to telegraph something really important, that the one whose genealogy this is will be the one who deals with, you know, reverses, rolls back the effect of the depravity brought on humanity by the Watchers. So there are all these sorts of undercurrents in the New Testament where if you're really familiar with the Watcher material from Enoch and you read certain things in the New Testament, either it helps when something's really strange, like 1 Peter 3, you know, why does Peter throw in, you know, into the blender, the ark, the flood, the spirits in prison, baptism, resurrection, what in the world is he thinking? Well, he's using the Enoch story as a type of Christ, just like Paul uses Adam as a type of Christ. It's very, very parsable, very understandable. But unless you're aware of it, it never sort of clicks in your head when you read the New Testament. And so that's what I'm trying to do in the book. You know, just, hey, look, read your New Testament with this in your head, and you'll begin to see how and why certain things are in the New Testament that you may have read many times before, but you weren't really parsing the way the writer intended you to parse it.
Hmm. Is there how much of the intertestamental literature that was available to the Jews do we consider now, and by we, I mean the Christian church, 21st century, mm-hmm. in general, when we analyze Christian theology? In other words, have we sort of blinded ourselves to the influence of that Jewish literature and the Jewish theological thought of the first century when it comes to analyzing and trying to parse Christian theology today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, scholars would say, you know, people who are in the field of especially New Testament or experts in Second Temple Judaism would say that basically there's hardly a place in the New Testament where something written in the Second Temple period isn't relevant for understanding. And that's because, again, they have their head in the material. That's all they do. So, you know, for the average Christian, though, that sounds completely foreign and probably absurd. You know, being, well, I've gotten along just fine without, you know, reading the Book of Maccabees or Enoch or any of this stuff, you know. Well, yeah, you have. The point is not that you're going to miss the gospel without this stuff and get the gist of the story. The point is that there's a lot going on in the stories, the way things are articulated, the way they're written. The writer wants you to think of certain things to help your understanding. And so you'll get a richer understanding. You'll get resolution to problem passages. Passages that you think are strange will all of a sudden make sense if you have this kind of material in your head. So it's really important, you know, for really a rich, a full understanding of the New Testament, this thing we say is inspired, because when God prompted people to write this thing that we call the New Testament, hey, guess what? They were living in the first century. They were first century Jews. They weren't morons. They were literate. They read this stuff. They quote it. They allude to it hundreds and hundreds of times. So it informed them and helped them articulate what they did put down under inspiration. But you and I aren't going to get that. We're not going to understand what they wanted us to understand in its fullness. And really, we're not going to get the impact of it without that material. So we do miss a lot. We may not miss the gospel, but we miss a lot of other things.
Hmm. It seems common sense when you stop and think about it, because, I mean, we wouldn't expect a first century writer to use like modern sports metaphors like, boy, you really threw me a curveball there, or, you know, that guy's out in left field. You know, somebody in the first century hearing those phrases wouldn't have a clue as to what those meant. But you used the phrase of in one of the Skywatch interviews of Christians having sort of an X-Files view of divine inspiration.
Yeah.
That suddenly, boom.
It's a big problem.
Yeah. But, and again, X-Files. No, first century, what are you talking about? X-File.
Right.
What is this that you're speaking of? And yet we don't look for similar cultural references from that era and question what they might mean. And even more obvious example, it's how we can interpret the description that Ezekiel gives in chapter one of what he saw as a UFO instead of what people in his day and time would have known.
We impose something in our head because of our culture, because of the time and place in which we live on an ancient text, you know, and that, you know, it's one of my fundamental gripes, you know, with ancient alien stuff. And I mean, I have a lot of gripes with that, but that's one of the biggest ones, because when you really think about what we're doing, I'm taking something from my world and inserting it into the world of the author. It sounds really stupid, and the reason is because it is stupid. Okay, if we wrote something today, using again the phrases that we use, the cultural allusions that we might put in there, references to a TV show or a commercial or even an item of clothing or a car, you know, any number of things. Well, 1,000 years from now or 2,000 years from now, you know, someone trying to understand that, if we knew that they were going to just insert their own culture in that and call it, you know, this is what the author meant and call it good. I mean, that would be ridiculous to us. You know, we would say, well, how dare you? I'm being misunderstood and you're not, you know, giving me any credit. You're not even trying to understand what I really wanted to say. And that's essentially what the ancient astronaut crowd does with the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, we don't really care what it meant in its own context. We're going to give it one, you know, and by golly, that's what we want it to say.
Yeah. Yeah. The Ezekiel's wheel and the ancient astronaut interpretation is one aspect of it. Someone else sent me a note the other day saying that Ezekiel's wheel is explained, or, you know, helps us explain and understand cosmology in another way. And I don't even want to open that can of worms, but,
you know, you think about it, you know, I did use the word X-Files, and what do you think of when you hear X-Files? You think paranormal,
right?
Okay. And so that's really what I'm getting at, that we have this weird paranormal view of inspiration where, you know, the product of inspiration, again, this thing we call the Bible, is really the result of God overtaking the writer's mind and sort of blanking him out, and, you know, the old automatic writing thing that the writer has really no say in the selection of words. The Spirit's giving them every word. And, you know, well, we know that's demonstrably false and ridiculous, because what they do produce, again, archaeology is just one example of showing how closely they followed this or that formula, you know, how epistles conform to the style of epistles, how Old Testament covenants conform to the style of covenants. Well, you don't need automatic writing for that. You need a writer that's intelligent, that actually reads stuff. You know, we strip the humanity out of the Bible, out of inspiration. And frankly, in my view, when you do that, you actually undermine the doctrine. You set it up to be attacked by really silly arguments, you know, in the name of making it so, again, paranormal, you know, to like, people think they have to do that to protect the Bible, to make it unique, you know, to make it this thing that God's responsible for. Well, God's still responsible for it, but he used people. Okay, he didn't tie their hands. He didn't freeze their brain. He used people, and he prepares them providentially through their whole life for this moment, you know, to produce something that he wants preserved for posterity and to address a specific need, a specific occasion. And you know, God can handle that. He can handle that job. He can put that person in the right time, the right place, the right frame of mind, the right education, just all the tools that he needs and says, you know, God can say, not get the job done. Hmm. And they can do it.
Coming back to 1 Peter 3, verses 14 through 22, because mm-hmm. I thought this was really fascinating when we discussed this for the Skywatch TV episode. A section that you say a pastor at a church you were trying out literally skipped over in a series of...
A day that will live in infamy.
Yeah. He was going through 1 Peter and exegetically verse by verse until he got to verse 14 of chapter 3. It's like, this is too weird. We're just going to skip over this.
We're just going to skip it.
And I recall in another context, you said, if it's in the Bible and it's weird, it's probably important. What... do we draw from 1 Peter 3, 14 through 22, and how does it refer back to the sin of the watchers?
Yeah, again, this is the one where Peter puts everything into a blender that we referred to a few minutes ago.
Makes sort of a theological smoothie.
Yeah, hey, I have half a chapter here to write, so like, what do we want to throw in here? You know, all this good stuff. See what comes out. Yeah, I mean, that's the impression you get from reading it, because you look at it and you go, you know, what do these things have in common? You know, why, if you want to talk about baptism, why don't you just talk about baptism? Why do you got to throw Noah in the flood and the spirits in prison? What are you doing? The only way you can really understand what Peter's trying to communicate here is to understand typology. And that is, if you think of prophecy, verbal prophecy is when, you know, a prophet would verbally utter, hey, thus says the Lord, XYZ is going to happen. So it's a verbal declaration of some impending future thing. Well, a type is a non-verbal prophecy, that there's an event that happens, okay, like the Exodus. Okay, there's an institution given to Israel, like the Passover. There's a person whose life prefigures something to come. So you get events and institutions and people that their role, one of their roles in the broad scope of the Bible, is to prefigure something that will happen in the New Testament era. And of course, that shows up in the New Testament text. And often Jesus is the reference for a lot of these things. And the best illustration I can think of is Romans chapter 5, where Paul views Adam and even calls Adam a tupos, a type of Jesus. He's a prefigurement of Jesus. So for Paul, Adam was a prefiguring person, a prefigurement of what, you know, Jesus would do and what his death meant. But for Peter, he viewed Enoch as a type. He viewed Enoch as this prefiguring precursor to Jesus. And the only way you can really understand that is if you know the story of Enoch, especially the sin of the watchers, where the watchers sin, God, you know, puts them in prison. Again, the spirit sent to prison, bound with chains. You get all that language that we read in Peter and Jude. That actually comes from Enoch. It doesn't come from Genesis 6. So you get this language, and the watchers are sitting there in the book of Enoch, and they look at themselves and say, boy, this was dumb. You know, this was a mistake. Mm-hmm. You know, we're sorry we did this. You know, we need to ask God to change his mind. And so they solicit Enoch to go to talk to God, be, hey, God likes you. You know, he took you to heaven and everything. You know, so can you go talk to God about reconsidering and letting us out? Tell him we're sorry. And so Enoch does that. You know, he goes to God, and then God says, you know, the short version is, tell him to forget it. You know, they're toast. And then he, again, using Peter's language, he descends back to not only earth, but beneath the earth. You know, he descends to the spirits in prison. And he announces their judgment. You know, he says, you know, God says no. You know, he's not going to change his mind. Well, for Peter, he saw an analogy there between Jesus, you know, Jesus dying and again going to the realm of the dead, because guess what? He's dead. That's where you go when you're dead. You go to the realm of the dead. And instead of, you know, talking about this other stuff with the spirits in prison, Jesus preaches to the spirits in prison something else. You know, they look at him and it's like, I mean, well, first of all, who's down there? Who, you know, who's a spiritual being in, you know, in prison, you know, in hell, as it were? Well, the watchers are there. You got, you know, demons there. I mean, you got, you know, the whole cast of characters there. And so they look at Jesus and it's like, yeah, you know, we pulled this off. We won. You know, here's the Son of God. What's he doing down here? How can the Son of God die? You know, guess we did a good job up there, or somebody did, you know, and killed off this guy. And so Jesus says, yeah, I'm here. I'm dead. I died on the cross. But guess what? In a couple of days, I'm going to be out of here, and you'll still be here. In other words, I didn't lose.
Mm-hmm.
This was the plan. I'm going to rise from the dead, and I'm going to pay the penalty for humanity. You know, and all who follow me, all who believe in me, believe and embrace the resurrection, you know, the whole point of the cross, you're never going to see them here either. And so it's an announcement of the defeat of the powers of darkness. And for Peter, what the event that we do that commemorated that was baptism. You know, the being united to Christ, you know, in terms of, you know, your belief in the resurrection. So we're going to baptize you based on your testimony and whatnot. You know, this is why the early church included renunciations of the devil and his angels in their baptismal formulas. They're basing this on 1 Peter 3 because of this, again, theological thinking. But you can only really pick it up if you know how Peter's thinking about Enoch.
Hmm. Well, in a broader sense, then, how did the Jews of the first century, and specifically the disciples, how did they view Enoch relative to Moses?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're familiar with different strains of Judaism at this time. We get that from the Gospels, you know, Pharisees, Sadducees, you know, the Zealots and whatnot. There were Jews, and, you know, scholars actually have a term for them, Enochian Judaism, because it's evidence that Qumran, based upon, you know, the books that have been discovered there, because they evidently valued them to put them in the library. And a lot of the Enochian stuff was preserved there. But we know from Philo and Josephus and, you know, other sources that there were certain Jews who valued and esteemed Enoch higher than Moses.
Hmm.
And that was because Enoch walked with God. It's because Enoch, again, was the first direct recipient of divine revelation from God. Again, this is how Enoch is cast in the Second Temple literature. Enoch essentially becomes the person that God speaks through. And Jude, of course, calls Enoch a prophet. He's the spokesperson for God, the seventh from Adam, which, you know, also, by the way, comes from the book of Enoch. But Enoch is the first person that God sort of uses as this conduit to tell people what he wants them to know, as opposed to the things that the watchers are teaching them. And so he becomes kind of this pride of place. This is the first spokesperson for God. And he, for some Jews, he was better than Moses, because the law comes along later as, again, sort of this stopgap effort to restrain the proliferation of wickedness on the earth.
Sort of a holding action,
right,
until the Messiah.
Right. You know, we got to do something here. They're not listening to what, you know, God is trying to communicate, you know, to them through Enoch, and of course through others as well in the Old Testament story. But, you know, the law again becomes this thing that just, again, tries to impede the progress of evil. So Enoch, for some, had a higher status.
Hmm. How do we see the sin of the watchers influencing the ministry of Jesus?
Yeah, the some of the places where Jesus goes and what he says when he's there become real important, again, if you have the watcher story in your head. And I talk a little bit about this in The Unseen Realm, where Jesus goes to Bashan. Okay, so Bashan was, again, the region associated with the giants. Okay, the Rephaim, Deuteronomy 2 and 3. Who, of course, we learn from Deuteronomy 2 and 3, were descendants, you know, the Anakim, or not descendants, but they were Anakim. They were like the Anakim, great and tall and all that. The Anakim, of course, come from the Nephilim, Numbers 13:33, and that takes us back to Genesis 6. So the conquest actually begins with wars against the descendants of the Nephilim in this region called Bashan. And right there, you know, close to where Og lived, and part of the territory where he ruled was, lo and behold, Mount Hermon. Mm. Again, this is the place where, according to the book of Enoch, the watchers descended to this mountain and, again, launched their plot, you know, made their pact with each other to corrupt humanity. So Jesus goes into these regions, and frankly, he goes to Mount Hermon. You know, we have the episode, the famous episode of the Peter's confession, you know, thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. Well, I argue in The Unseen Realm, and I'll make the argument here too in the new book, that, you know, the whole reference here is to the rock. It's to the place where they're standing, right here at the foot of Mount Hermon, right here in the region of Bashan. You know, this is the place associated with Baal and the watchers, and Baal is the Satan figure, and the watchers, well, we know who they are. You know, they're the ones who made humanity so wicked, and this transgression, you know, that produced the giants. And here we are standing in Bashan, and we know what the giants are about. Moses and Joshua had to put up with them and, you know, get rid of them. So again, all this whole matrix of ideas, you know, Jesus goes into this place and he says this, you know, you're Peter, you know, and upon this rock, I'm going to build my church and the gates of hell will not be able to withstand it. Well, he's essentially saying, I'm going to take Satan's home and make it his tomb. You know, he picks a fight. I mean, this is inflammatory rhetoric. And then the gospels say, well, 6 days later, they go up, you know, into the mountain a little ways. Well, what? There's only one mountain there. It's mm-hmm. Hermon. And guess what happens there? Well, it's the transfiguration. And so Jesus is like, okay, boys, you know, I'm here. You know, he shows the disciples, you know, Peter, James, and John, who he really is. But they're not the only ones there for the show. You know, the powers of darkness that we don't see get the message too. Well, he's here. He's the Son of God. And we got to do something, you know, and of course their solution is to kill him, you know, which is exactly what needs to happen. And it's interesting. The gospel writers make the point of saying that after the transfiguration, from this point on, Jesus began to teach his disciples that the Son of Man must go to Jerusalem and die. And the disciples are freaked out. Like, this is awesome. Mm-hmm. You know, we get to go up and, you know, poke Satan in the eye. We poke the watchers in the eye. And this is great stuff, you know? And then you turn around and talk about now you got to go and die. Like, this is crazy talk, you know, and we know Peter's reaction.
Yeah.
You know, but that's it. A week later, you get the triumphal entry, and a week after that, he's dead. You know, mission accomplished. Because Jesus went up there to poke a fight because he knew this is what has to happen, and it's time to make it happen. It's time to provoke the powers of darkness into doing what they think is the solution, but what he and the Father knew was the beginning of their end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating that in 1 Corinthians,
yeah,
Paul makes the case that, you know,
if the rulers of this world known, they would never have crucified the Lord of glory.
And of course, the word rulers, the Greek word that Paul chooses to use there is applied at times to spiritual.
The powers of darkness, right. Spiritual darkness. And the singular is as well, ruler. It's a word used for Satan. You know? So yeah, it's familiar vocabulary, not just for, you know, earthly rulers, but for, you know, cosmic, you know, sinister powers of darkness rulers.
Yeah, it's fascinating that they didn't understand the nature of his mission. Clearly, the disciples didn't understand the nature of the mission.
They had no idea.
Even 40 days later in Acts chapter 1, are you going to restore the kingship to Israel now? They didn't quite get it.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter on that in Unseen Realm about my view that messianic prophecy is deliberately cryptic. For that very reason.
And I'm cribbing that for my presentation in July at the Prophecy Conference, might not go over well. It's like, with all due respect to you fellows here, none of us have this picture. But the whole point of my presentation is that how a misunderstanding and holding too closely to a misinformed position will lead to lots and lots of bloodshed before it's all over. The spiritual nature of this fight, You made an interesting point in the interview, the interview that'll be televised, that the Jews of the first century, if we were to go to them and say, you know, why is humanity in this decadent state? What caused this? They would have a very different answer than 21st century Christians.
Yeah.
What would they say?
Yeah. I mean, why is the world the way it is? Why is depravity what it is? The average Christian would say, oh, well, that's the fall. That's because of the fall. That's, you know, the serpent, the garden, Adam and Eve, and all that. Well, a first century Jew would say, well, that's part of the explanation, but they wouldn't leave it there. For the first century Jew, there were really three prongs to the answer of, you know, why are things as bad as they are? And the first one is Genesis 3, what happens in the garden. The second one, though, is the sin of the watchers, the sin of the sons of God in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. Which again they viewed as being a terrific in terms of magnitude, I'm using that word, catalyst to the proliferation of evil through the human race. So that played a big part in how they would answer the question, why are people so wicked? Well, because of the watchers. You know, if they hadn't come down here and corrupted humanity, we wouldn't be in this mess. And the third element to the answer is what happens at Babel. You know, the Tower of Babel story, but if you go to Deuteronomy 32, 8, and 9, and of course, you know, tracking the whole, you know, course of the language there, in Deuteronomy 32, 8, and 9 says, when the Most High divided up the nations, he divided them up according to the number of the sons of God. Again, that's reading the text with the Dead Sea Scrolls there. again, the idea that God punished humanity for disobedience at Babel by essentially severing the relationship between him and humans. And he assigns humanity, again, the nations that we read in Genesis 10 that are associated with the Babel episode, he assigns them to be governed by lesser gods, the Elohim, lesser Elohim of his council. And, you know, Paul hints, you know, Paul alludes to this in Acts 17, where he talks about the establishing the boundaries of the peoples, that it had something to do with bringing the nations, you know, to the truth of the Messiah and whatnot. And you think, well, what's he talking about? Well, you know, there's a divorce at Babel, but it's not a permanent divorce. You know, verse 9 of Deuteronomy 32 says, Israel is Yahweh's portion, Jacob is his allotted inheritance. And that comes from the fact that right after God divorces the nations, he calls Abraham, starts a new nation, which we know as Israel, and he tells Abraham, look, you know, you're going to be the guy that I'm going to make my people from, but through you, all the other nations will be blessed. We're not going to forget about them. And again, Paul understood this point. He understood the situation. So if you asked, again, a first century Jew, they would say, well, not only do we have the garden, not only do we have the watchers, but I mean, the reason why the nations, you know, the people around us who aren't Jews, aren't descendants of Abraham, are worshiping other gods and basically getting abused by those deities and imprisoned and enslaved, is because the gods of the nations that used to be loyal to Yahweh rebelled. And we read that in Psalm 82. And so for a Jew, it's like, this is just a huge problem. Hmm. And so since they're processing the problem with those three prongs, when they think about the solution, they don't think of the Messiah as only solving Genesis 3. They don't think of the Messiah as only solving the mortality, the eternal death problem of man. They think of the Messiah as the one who will reverse the proliferation of evil through the whole earth caused by the watchers, and who will bring back the nations into the family of God with the physical descendants of Abraham. I mean, for them, it's the whole package. And, you know, the average Christian misses 2/3 of it, mm-hmm. because of the way we're taught about those things. Mm.
So that would be the reversing Herman, yeah. aspect of it in the book,
yeah.
the work of the Messiah and yeah. Undoing the destruction that's been worked yeah, on the earth.
This is the Messiah's job. This is why he shows up. It's not just about Adam. It's about Enoch and the Watchers and the sin of the Watchers. The sin of the Watchers has to be addressed. And again, what that means is the problem of depravity and who caused it. They're going to be judged, and humanity is going to be made new. Again, and of course, they have to accept the presence of the Messiah, who he is, what his message is, and all that. But they're going to be processing the Messiah in light of Genesis 6, 1 through 4, which again sounds, you know, really kind of crazy, you know, to the average Christian. But again, if a Jew, a first century Jew, was sitting here with us, he'd be yawning now, because this is like theology 101, hmm. you know, for them. But for us, it's quite different.
So how has that affected our walk today as Christians? I mean, what has been the impact on the church as a whole of just kind of doing away with
the de-supernaturalizing,
right? Getting rid of the Genesis 6 paradigm and of course, the yeah. Deuteronomy 32, the divine council paradigm.
Yeah, I would say we've succeeded quite well in making the Bible boring.
we bleached all the color out, right. And then we complain that it's boring.
Yeah, you know, I'm serious, you know, in that, you know, we've reduced, I actually like the phrase you used in the interview earlier today, that Jesus has become the cosmic life coach. And that's pretty much what he is. You know, we can sit here and complain about what happens in church, and lots of people do. Well, I go to church and I hear the same Bible stories. I hear, be nice to your wife. I hear, don't be abusive to your kids, and, you know, be a nice guy. And, mm-hmm. oh, okay, thanks, life coach, you know, because that's basically what I'm getting. I'm getting, you know, therapy here.
Get that from Dr. Phil.
Yeah, you really can. And you know, the Bible becomes the same old stories over the pulpit, but now we have adult illustrations. You know, mm-hmm. look, if that's all there is to it, I can't blame people for being bored with it. How many times do you have to hear this stuff to you know, have the light go off in your head saying, I've heard this too many times. Mm-hmm. There's got to be something more to this thing we call the Bible.
Right, right.
There just has to be more. And, you know, I've sort of made it, you know, my, if you want to call it a ministry, I don't know what you really call what I do, but if you want to call it that, that's fine. But I've sort of made it my business to find people who just know, they just have this inkling, this intuitive sense that there's got to be more to this than what I'm getting in church, because it's killing me. Okay, I am dying on the vine here. I am not being fed, because I can get this on Dr. Phil. There's just got to be more to it. You know, my experience is that we pastors and you know, other Christian leaders and authorities, including scholars here, we're not going to leave, you know, my little, you know, tribe out of the criticism here. But we regularly underestimate the interest of the normal person in the pew in biblical theology, and we also underestimate their aptitude for it. And thinking people know when they're not being asked to think. And every church, I think, has a handful of these people that are just, they're just withering. They're intellectually withering. They're spiritually withering because they're not being fed. Mm. So, and I think we have ourselves to blame for that.
It's like a comment Pat Sajak once said when he was asked about what it was like to host, what's the game show that he hosts?
Wheel of Fortune
every day for like the last 3 decades. He said, there are some days when I can hear my brain cells flaking off and hitting the floor. If all that church is a reminder every Sunday morning that everything you needed to learn about life you picked up in kindergarten, right. You know, be nice, share your toys, and you know, play well with others, then there's no point.
How does that have meaning anymore?
Yeah, you can spend your Sunday mornings doing something more productive and more helpful to humanity. But there is a lot in here, and this is one of those things that struck me. 12 years ago when I first tried my hand at writing a novel and wanted to include some theological things in it, I had, you know, grown up as a science fiction fan, assuming that there was no way you could make science fiction, you could incorporate theology and especially Christianity into science fiction until I began to realize that the palette that you have in the Bible contains everything you need for a great story.
It's meta-narrative.
You've got gods and monsters and dragons and demons and heroes and warriors and conflict of ultimate good and evil. It's all in there, but we never hear about it except in very simple terms on Sunday mornings. I mean, Noah has been reduced to a kindly grandfather figure, looks kind of like Santa Claus and loves animals.
Yeah. And probably drools, you know, just.
Yeah, you know, and he's all about saving the earth because humanity, if you believe the movie, was, you know, destroying the earth even, you know, 4,500 years ago. There's more to it than this. We could continue, but in the interest of keeping this to a manageable podcast length, you know, this theology has implications for spiritual warfare, and you've addressed that in your podcast, The Naked Bible. I've linked to it in the past. We'll do so again because the interview with Fern and Audrey was eye-opening. Mm-hmm. And for you listening, if you've not considered how the divine counsel paradigm might apply in a spiritual warfare context, listen to the interview that I will link to in the show notes at vftb.net because it is mind-blowing. Also, read Mike's novels, The Facade and The Portent, for some depictions of how, and in fact, in The Portent, one that turned out to be a little more realistic than you probably figured at the time you wrote it. You'll hear that when you hear the interview with Fern and Audrey on how this actually has real-world application. When the book Reversing Herman comes out, we will definitely make you aware of it. And if you have time, you know, get you back for another discussion of it. In the meanwhile, where do people go to follow everything else that you're doing as far as podcast, blog, and so, and the Paranormal Podcast? Give us a brief description of that, too.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. I mean, the Nerve Center for everything I do is my homepage, dr, as in doctor, msh.com, drmsh.com. So if you go there, you'll have links to the novels. You'll have links again to, you know, The Unseen Realm, the nonfiction I do, the Naked Bible Podcast. We do an episode every week, and as Derek mentioned, we started another podcast called Peer Anormal. That's PEER and then Anormal. So peeranormal.com. We're two episodes in, and the gist of that podcast is we want to talk about paranormal things, but we are restricting our discussion to peer-reviewed literature. In other words, there are actual scientists in actual labs, you know, real people in real white coats who actually study things that we would call paranormal, and they write up their studies in academic journals that, you know, pass peer review. So a lot of people don't even know this kind of research exists. And so myself, my friend Trey from the Naked Bible Podcast is part of it. Natalina, some of you will know who she is. She's going to be a co-host. Brian Gadawa, mm-hmm. and Chris Putnam, and anybody else that, you know, we find along the way that would really make a good co-chair for any given topic. You know, we're going to bring into that and talk about peer-reviewed material on the paranormal.
Yeah.
So you can find it there as well, drmsh.com.
That should be really fascinating. And I know the one I described the episode just posted to Sharon last night, and apparently she had already read that.
Oh, the one article,
that,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that report. So, yeah, some fascinating stuff there, and it's worth looking at because there, as far as I know, there aren't any other Christians who are looking at that type of work and then trying to process it through a biblical lens or, you know, through a biblical filter.
This is quite a unique niche. I mean, I was surprised that nobody's done this before, because if you do research on parapsychology, for instance, online, you will run into peer-reviewed research. And it's like, why doesn't anybody talk about this?
Yeah.
And so it just seemed like a natural idea for a podcast.
Well, you know, and you and Putnam and Gadawa and Natalina together, that's like, you know, the million-dollar quartet of Christian podcasting right there. So we're just excited about that. Mike, the author of The Unseen Realm, Recovering the Supernatural Worldview of the Bible, forthcoming book, which we're eagerly awaiting, Reversing Hermann, The Importance of the Sin of the Watchers in the Book of Enoch for New Testament Theology. Mike, thanks for your time. I think this makes about 10 hours worth of recording you've done in the last 2 days. So both of us are
sweet.
due for dinner and a cold one, I think.
Well, that was fun. I'm just glad to be here and do something useful, and thanks for the opportunity.
If you log on to vftb.net, you'll find a link in the show notes to the main website for Mike, his hub of internet activity, if you will, drmsh.com. The link's there in the show notes. And the show notes, as always, posted to vftb.net. That's View from the Bunker, vftb.net. And click through to Mike's website, and from there to all of his various and sundry websites. His Naked Bible blog, the Paleo Babble blog, UFO Religions blog, his Memra Online Learning Institute, and other things that he's working on. Highly recommend the book, The Unseen Realm. His two novels, The Facade and The Portent, both in the reference rack of the books that I keep in the office at home, because he's got them so well researched and documented with real information from the UFO phenomenon. I will turn to that, because I can trust that Mike has vetted the research that's gone into those novels. And of course, the Divine Council paradigm shows up in those novels as well. So it's fascinating stuff. This week on Skywatch TV, and I'm saying this because explaining why I'm not going to have a whole lot of news to comment on here at the end of this particular program, took the Memorial Day weekend to kind of get my head out of the news for a few days and focus on the presentation I'll be delivering, God willing, at the Rocky Mount International Prophecy Conference. Somebody pointed out, by the way, just a quick detour, that whenever we talk about a future event, because we never know, none of us, that we've got tomorrow guaranteed. So looking just 8 weeks into the future, or I guess it's even less than that now, 6 weeks? Yee. And saying, I will do this in 6 weeks' time. Well, yeah, if God wills it, you know, unless he's got something else in mind. So always cognizant of that. So if I don't remember to say that, just know that that's kind of in the back of my mind. Anyway, Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference, July 15th through the 17th, the presentation I'll be giving, working on that and trying to outline it in a way that I can then flesh it out into a book before the end of the year. And I think it's interesting. I hope you will find it interesting as well, but because I spent basically 72 hours more or less focused on that, got my head out of the news, and I knew that this week coming up, we've got guests at Skywatch TV that will take up the three days because of the holiday of daily news updates this week. But I don't think you'll be disappointed at not getting the news updates, because the guests are, Mike Heiser for Tuesday and Wednesday, and then Thursday, Gary Haven returns. His movie, Armageddon, opened on May 13th. We talked to him about that, 6 weeks ago or so. Well, he's coming back, and there's a rumor, not confirmed, but there's a rumor that the director of the film, Mike Norris, will be here as well. I guess I'll find out tomorrow when I show up to work. So anyway, all that said to explain why I've not really had my head in the news much over the last few days and really don't have a whole lot to talk about. I did see an item that I thought was really intriguing, and kudos to Tom Horn for picking this out, because this is what was like a throwaway line in a story at a news site that I wasn't, you know, I look at it on a regular basis, but I didn't know that, that Tom was looking at it. It's a site that focuses on Middle Eastern news called AI Monitor, and or Al Monitor. And they do a really good job of presenting a fairly balanced view of what's going on in the Middle East. They published an article a few days back, and I missed it. So again, I'm thankful that Tom caught it, because there's an intriguing line in here that the reporter for Al Monitor included in his story, but didn't expound upon. He just kind of let it lie there like a live grenade. The story about how the civil turmoil and the violent unrest in Iraq since 2003 has led the archaeological sites in Iraq, which go back to the very earliest days of human civilization. I mean, that's where Sumer was located, okay, in Iraq. So the very earliest human civilization and the remains, the archaeological remnants of that civilization are right there in southeast Iraq, close to the Persian Gulf. But, you know, you're not going to get archaeologists who want to go there and dig if there's a danger of being shot at least not many. So that was the premise of the story, how this has been bad for some of the archaeological sites there. And in particular, they were looking at the ancient city of Uruk, U-R-U-K. It's also translated Erek, E-R-E-C-H, in some English Bibles. It basically was the seat of Nimrod's kingdom back in the day. And the influence that Nimrod had was so powerful that even though we don't know very much about him from sources that we can trust, he only gets a few lines in the Bible. The memory of what he created there, based out of the city-state of Uruk, which was also, by the way, the seat of power for Gilgamesh, who is considered by most historians now to be an actual historic character. The name has been preserved in the modern-day name of Iraq. So, you know, this was not some, you know, minor historical figure that we can just dismiss. And it's a shame that the ancient city of Uruk is not being examined by archaeologists, but it's just too dangerous there. But in the middle of this article is this throwaway line where the reporter for Al Monitor quotes a local farmer named Ahmed Al-Zawalm. And he said that he grew up in Uruk. But he said since the 90s, he's only come near the site one time when some guests wanted to visit the place. And it's basically abandoned now. There's no power there. There's no water. And he's saying, I've only come here once to visit when some guests wanted to visit the place. And then he adds this: there is no point in visiting this site that shelters forces of evil, harbors demons, and witnesses every now and then supernatural phenomena. End quote. Again, the reporter just let that lie there. Didn't follow up. Didn't make that the center of another article. I just thought that was fascinating. And again, tip of the headphones to Tom Horn for catching that particular story and posting it at skywatchtv.com. Significant? Yeah, maybe. Am I surprised? Not really. But would have liked to have seen the reporter for Al Monitor follow up on that kind of throwaway comment. An article from Stars and Stripes reports that the U.S. Army is now testing driverless vehicles. They were running a test on some roads in Michigan, driverless military vehicles. Not quite sure what the actual application will be at some point in the future, but I could see perhaps it making sense to run driverless convoys to dangerous forward operating bases. You know, drivers, I mean, if the truck breaks down, you don't have drivers stuck out in the middle of the desert, you know, and risking lives. So, I mean, there's a potential application there. But it is interesting that Google and a number of auto manufacturers, Ford, Daimler, and others, are full-on actively working toward creating the driverless car, even though research shows again and again that most of us don't want it. Most of us don't want driverless vehicles. Now, they'll probably overcome our objections and sell us on it because I'm at the tail end of the baby boom, and I'm 54. Okay? The real bulge in the demographic curve for the baby boom is older than me. And there's going to come a time when a lot of those folks really shouldn't be driving, but they don't want to be stuck at home. So that will probably be one potential market. On the other hand, a lot of those folks grew up just prior to the advent and became adults prior to the advent of the computer age. I mean, the personal computer age. I mean, I did too, but I've always been kind of a geek, so I kind of gravitated toward it anyway. But there will come a point where I think the younger generation that's grown up with computer technology around them since they were born will feel comfortable enough to trust an AI to drive the vehicle for them. Me, I've seen too many blue screens of death to want a blue screen of death to actually mean a blue screen of death. But having said that, again, the military is testing it out, and probably, here's the other place we're going to find it, we're going to find AI drivers, robot drivers, taking the place of long-haul truck drivers. Because being a long-haul driver, you can make a decent living wage. You can support a family on that. It's not an easy way to earn a living by any stretch of the imagination, but you can earn a decent wage. In fact, before the economy really started slowing down here about a year and a half ago, there was a shortage of drivers. There was essentially a negative number in front of the unemployment rate for commercial drivers, which is why trucking companies were offering bonuses, $6,000, $8,000, $10,000 sign-on bonuses to get drivers to drive for them. They had more loads than they could carry. Now, things have slowed down some, and I don't know how that's changed, but I know just before I left the steel company, we had a bear of a time getting stuff moved those last few months. And getting guys to drive for our company was a challenge because the companies that specialized in just hiring drivers were offering such attractive sign-on bonuses. But if those companies can save that annual salary by putting a CPU in the driver's seat instead of an actual human, I predict that is going to happen. So anyway, well, that's it for the commentary today. Coming up, still got a couple of interview requests out there, and so the schedule is subject to change. I will say that I dropped a note to Doug Stauffer to talk about his new book, The Blessed Hope of Thessalonians. And got a couple of others out there. L.A. Marzulli, too. We'll probably talk to him as he gets closer to the release of Watchers 10. They're starting some pre-sale on it now, and there's a trailer out, which I should get to the website and post at the website shortly. Told him I would, so now I got to follow up on it. But we'll have L.A. Marzulli back to talk about that at some point in the very near future. As we get closer to July, we'll be gearing up for that. So I'm not sure if the schedule is going to maintain a weekly frequency, but we'll see how that goes. The good news is, though, that when I come back from the conference, again, God willing, we'll have plenty of audio from the 32 speakers at the conference. or 25 speakers, rather. It's 32 presentations, I believe. Maybe even more. But yeah, hopefully we'll get to talk to all of them or nearly all of them, and then we'll be kind of spinning that audio out to you in the weeks and months ahead on A View from the Bunker. Remember, our weekly Bible study continues every Sunday morning at gilberthouse.org, the Gilbert House Fellowship. We do a couple hours every week, post those usually by midday Sunday, 1 hour on the Old Testament, 1 hour on the New Testament. And we're finding as we go through that when you open your eyes to the reality of other supernatural entities that have rebelled against God, and the Bible, view the Bible as a chronicle, read the Bible as a chronicle of the supernatural war between those entities and between Yahweh, the one, the creator, who spoke everything into existence. Boy, it makes the Bible a lot more interesting. I mean, I hate to say that because it sounds like, you know, I can't read, you know, that books don't hold my attention unless there's lots of fights and explosions and stuff. That's not it. It's just that the faith, as it's been presented to us in Sunday school and Sunday mornings at church, for most of us, has been drained of the real impact of the struggle that's taking place and has been ongoing since the beginning of history. So we hope you'll join us. And again, you'll find all of those studies archived and available for your download for free at gilberthouse.org. We appreciate your reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you find A View from the Bunker. And of course, we discuss these topics at the View from the Bunker page on Facebook. Give us a like there and weigh in. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We do this because we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.